It is sunny, 18 degrees Kenosha, 17 in Racine, 16 for Burlington, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. Wind chill is minus 8. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Tuesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Over the last few days, I have been devouring a very substantial and fascinating book called Quick Moving and Quick Changing over their long histories are having to become exactly that in a lot of different ways. That is part of what is explored in this fascinating new book, again called Commencement, The Beginning of a New Era in Higher Education. And I'm so happy to say that one of the co-authors of this really interesting book is a proud Carthage alum, Kate Colbert, who graduated from Carthage with a degree in English. Kate Colbert currently serves on the President's Leadership Council at Carthage, and she has collaborated with Joe Salustillo in this collection, which draws, among other things, from the insights and reflections of more than 100 college and university presidents across the country. And many of those contributions actually stem from a really interesting podcast called The Ed Up Experience. And it was no small matter to gather together and, in a sense, sort of curate and edit and put into some coherent form all of these contributions from all of these important figures from higher education. But that has been done, and it is a really important and intriguing book. And I'm very excited that Kate Colbert, who actually lives right here in Kenosha, can join us right here in the studios of WGTD to talk about her fascinating book. Kate Colbert, we welcome you to the morning show.
So great to be here.
Glad we can have this conversation. Let's get a little bit of personal stuff out of the way. Explain, first of all, your specific connection to Carthage College as an alum. What drew you to Carthage in the first place? Are you originally from this area?
That's a great story. So a long, long time ago, when I was much, much younger, I grew up actually just across the border in northern Illinois and Grays Lake, Illinois. And I did my last 2 years at Carthage College. So I had an associate's degree from the College of Lake County in Grays Lake, transferred up to Carthage as a junior, and finished up my English degree at Carthage, which was a really amazing experience for me, coming from a family who otherwise could not have afforded to send me to a private liberal arts college for 4 years. I had the opportunity to earn that degree, and today I still look back at all of the sort of nameless folks who were behind some of the scholarships that made that possible, which is why I continue to support Carthage and actually have a named scholarship there right now. And yes, just yesterday got a beautiful letter in the mail, actually, from a senior at Carthage who is about to graduate, who has been receiving the named scholarship that we funded all through. His name is Cameron, and he's just amazing. And so just so proud to be affiliated. I actually lost touch with Carthage for many years. You know, went off to graduate school and got a master's in comparative literature and composition right out of undergrad, and then went into a career as an English professor initially. And then decided that while I really love teaching people how to write, I didn't love it as much as I love writing. And so went ahead and jumped into the magazine publishing industry and became a writer in the high-tech world, something I knew nothing about. English major, no background in engineering whatsoever. But I'm really proud to say that by the time I finished my stint in semiconductor packaging, people were asking where I got my engineering degree. So I was pulling off the bluff pretty well, I think. And that was a really great experience. I was actually the first journalist in the world to break a story about a little technology that I thought might create some innovation in wireless communication called Bluetooth. So so that was a great experience. And then I went into, believe it or not, back into higher education, became a director of communications at what is now Rosalind Franklin University of Medicine and Science down in North Chicago, home of Chicago Medical School and the Dr. William M. Scholl College of Podiatric Medicine. Spent several years there and then took over as the director of marketing at Lake Forest Graduate School of Management, which is a standalone MBA program where I ultimately had earned my MBA just before working there. So I've spent a lot of time in higher ed as a student with four different degrees and have spent a lot of time working inside higher ed and then consulting to higher ed afterward. And it's just really my love. I've always said, if you can't go to college for the rest of your life, the second best thing is to work at one. And that has been my experience. I will say I have amended that now that I have been many, many years as a consultant to colleges and universities and not working inside one of them. It's actually more fun to be on the outside because I can serve more of them. And this book allows me to serve all 4,000 of them in the United States and, of course, beyond.
Wonderful. The story behind kind of the creation of this particular book and some of the interesting collaborations that it represents is really interesting in and of itself. I wonder if you could kind of tell us about the crossing of paths, some of that somewhat coincidental, which really led to this terrific collaboration and ultimately this really important and fascinating book.
Yeah, it was. I think it was almost fated. So I've been very busy the last several years. I have plenty of experience authoring nonfiction books. In 2018, I released a book called Think Like a Marketer, How a Shift in Mindset Can Change Everything for Your Business. And that book did very well. And it was a great opportunity for me to help corporate marketers and entrepreneurs figure out how to position their organizations better, and had a whole lot of fun with that book and continue to, actually. And I've been running a communications consulting company all along that I founded about 20 years ago. And I also happen to own a small collaborative publishing company where we represent about 250 authors. And so I live sort of in this bookish space while also consulting and doing a lot of market research for colleges and universities, including, you know, top 50 national research institutions. And I just happened to get a phone call one day from one of my authors who said, I know somebody who I think you should know. And he runs this podcast and he wants to write a book. And I said, sure, send him my way. So I had a meeting, just a get-to-know-you meeting with Dr. Joe Sallustio, who at the time was working at a different university than where he is now. And he told me this story that, you know, hey, a colleague of mine, Elvin Freitas, and I started this podcast called the EdUp Experience Podcast. And it's where we invite people at every level and in every function of higher education to come to the microphone and talk about what's really happening in higher education. And in fact, we also invite people in the sort of ecosystem of higher ed. So the head of education at Google or whatnot. And he said, you know, we've interviewed a lot of presidents of colleges and universities. And at that time, they were coming up on 100 presidents. And he said their insights are amazing. And somebody ought to collect this into a book. And I said, that's great, Joe. Do you want to write a book? Are you asking me to consider publishing that? And he said, well, here's the thing. I don't have time to write it. And I laughed. And I said, I'm guessing someone's told you I'm a professional writer and I've ghosted some books too. And I said, are you asking me to write the book for you? And he said, maybe. And so we kicked off what really became a friendship and really started talking about the work they were doing. And I started listening to some of the interviews on the EdUp Experience and realize there is something really powerful here. Because unless folks have been listening to EdUp from the very beginning, very few people are going to be able to make the time to go back and listen to 100 episodes of Presidents and to be able to really sort of coalesce the themes and figure out what does it all mean? And what does it mean for me if I work in higher education? Or what does it mean for my kid if they're headed off to college? And so I was hooked. And I said, absolutely. And I said, but by the way, I have expertise in higher education. I've worked in it. I consult to it. I said, I think my name should be on this book too. Let's write this together. Let's partner. And it was just magic. The co-founder of EdUp, Elvin Freites, wrote sidebars for the book as well. But Joe and I got to work and I started listening. We ultimately used for the research 125 college and university presidents. And we did additional research, anonymous research with higher education professionals to find out what they were really feeling and thinking and what was happening inside their institutions. So the book is full of proprietary information and really exciting thoughts. The timing was really fascinating as well. So the EdUp Experience podcast launched in January 2020, right? So not knowing we were about to be hit with a global pandemic, which would change higher education forever, somewhat for the better and somewhat for the worst, the microphone was on at the EdUp Experience podcast, and higher education leaders, folks at the C-suite, those presidents, those chief academic officers, rarely will speak to the media historically without checking every word with their PR person, right? But something magical happened when everyone went home and started working from home during quarantine, and they started accepting interviews without running it past the powers that be. And the conversations became really candid, and the conversations were happening during crisis. And quite by happenstance, this book ended up having really, really phenomenal insights about leadership during exigent circumstances and how to take, as you had said in this intro, how do you take an industry that is just historically known for moving incredibly slowly, and how do you move it on a dime for the benefit of the students and the faculty and the staff who are in a really, really scary situation, as it were. And so we had an opportunity to hear from presidents things that they might never have said otherwise. And it was magic. Joe and Elvin actually call me their purple unicorn because they were, they needed somebody to help write it. They needed somebody to help analyze it. And with my background in market research and turning data into stories, and I happen to own a publishing company, so that made it really easy for us to get the book published and distributed to all the right bookstores. And so it was about a 3-year process and about 15 months of me doing the research and the writing. And here we are.
That is really amazing. And I remember, we'll talk more specifically about COVID a little bit later in the interview, but I remember somebody remarking, and maybe it was you, about how that podcast ended up being, in a sense, a real-time chronicle.
Absolutely.
Of what it was like for higher education, and specifically the leaders of higher education, to grapple with what was happening. And of course, at that point in time, it was fraught with all kinds of unknowns.
Right.
And so you're not only dealing with a very, very difficult situation, but one that was evolving. And what we knew sometimes changed, and so on, and to have, in a sense, again, unfolding in real time, kind of a chronicle of what it was like to be confronting that.
Absolutely.
That in of itself makes it just an invaluable document. I'm reminded, although this book is very different from the books I'm about to cite, but I happen to be a big fan of what I think are called oral histories.
Yep.
And particularly, I enjoy oral histories about lighter topics, like on the show I've talked to the author of a oral history about the TV show Modern Family. And for those who haven't read a book like that, it's all these different people weighing in with their observations about various aspects of the show. And it almost looks like a script with the people's name in bold and then a colon and then what they have to say. And so there's very little in the way of a narrator's voice. And that's different from commencement, where we're hearing quite a lot from you. And these observations dropped in from all these different college professors. It looks more like a standard book. I'm just bringing up the oral history thing, though, because I remember talking to a couple of these different authors about how much harder that is than it might seem to be. I mean, it might seem like you just have this file drawer with a bunch of really interesting quotes from a bunch of people, and you just decide which one goes where, and that's it. But actually, that curating process and then figuring out how to make a coherent narrative out of all of that, it's actually incredibly difficult. And and I came away from both of those interviews with a really new appreciation for that. I should think that this book represented a very similar kind of challenge, in that you had almost both a luxury and a curse of having so much interesting information from so many interesting people. And what is it you do with it? How do you make sense of it and in a way where it will make sense to the reader?
Yeah, well, thank you for recognizing that. And we've been really honored by a lot of media outlets. And Forbes was one of the first to say that the work to create this book was just Herculean. And it really wasn't. It was, for me as a writer and as a researcher, it was the most difficult and most meaningful project I've ever done. And probably will not find its equal in my career going forward, and I'd be okay with that. You know, so yeah, the process was really somewhat scientific, you know. So we started, I was late to the game in listening to the episodes of the Oedipus Experience podcast. So, you know, I had to start with saying, okay, which ones are the most important to listen to first and get advice from Joe on that. And then sit down in front of, you know, the speakers of my computer and thank goodness for a software that helps transcribe things. We use Descript. And I started listening to every single episode by a president or a chief leader like a chancellor. And I would listen and I'd hear something brilliant and I'd stop and I'd copy paste it out of the transcript. But of course, ultimately, the transcripts have all kinds of weird things that are not what people actually said. So I would have to go through and change them and listen again and type it and get it perfect. And then I would just kept dumping brilliant things into sort of a source document of great quotes. And ultimately, we had hundreds of pages of that. And then what do you do with that? And then I sat down and started going through them and literally using multiple colored highlighters and started sort of hand coding and figuring out what are the top themes? Are there six? Are there eight? Are there 10? It literally took us probably, you know, 6-8 months of research and work in this to be able to get to a table of contents for the book to figure out what is the outline look for the, like for this. And then once we were there, then it got really exciting. And then I was able to start figuring out which quotes go in which section, which took many, 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 many weeks. and then figuring out which voices sort of led the conversation on the particular topic, whether it was about sort of students as customers or, you know, faculty-student relationships or the financials of higher education and what keeps the lights on. We had an entire chapter about the pandemic lessons, et cetera. And so organizing that content was just massive process. And so I kept feeling like, oh my gosh, my co-author must think that I'm totally ghosting on him because I had nothing to show him for month after month after month. And I kept saying, I'm working on it. I swear, I'm listening to the episodes. I'm marking them up. I used to send him photographs of binders with post-it notes and scribbled notes. And I just kept saying, like, I can't prove to you that this is going to become a book, but I promise you that it will. And it's all sort of swirling around in my head. And so the color coding and the organizing, and eventually, very, very far down the road, I finally was able to sit down and write the introduction because I understood what the book was going to be. And you're absolutely right. We could have done the really easy thing and have just taken a whole bunch of brilliant quotes from all these presidents of colleges and universities and strung them together under sort of different themes and said, you figure it out.
Right.
But listen, academia is full of difficult, horrible, poorly written books, right? We didn't want this to sound like a dissertation, nor did we want it to feel like some sort of dictionary or encyclopedia. We wanted the readers to be taken on a journey. We wanted them to feel like they had had the conversation with these college and university presidents, and we wanted to help stitch that together. Now, that is to say, we did not have an agenda going into this. So I didn't have 5 arguments I wanted to make about the future of higher education. We listened to what did the president say about the future of higher education. And what I love about this book, actually, is that, you know, we'll show you an argument in chapter 2 that somebody else tears apart in chapter 7. And it's up to you as a reader to figure that out, though we do give you guideposts and the narration really sort of helps sort of pull it together. And it's no secret sort of where Joe and I stand on some of these issues throughout the book. And then, of course, we do go deep at the very end. So every president who was interviewed for the Oedipus Experience podcast and for this book was asked, what do you think the future of higher education looks like? And ultimately, Joe and I do answer that question ourselves in the epilogue of the book, but we really let the president speak first. And I joked with my husband when we were going through this because there was a lot of change in higher ed while we were writing this book, right? The pandemic and and students really just wanting different things, and a lot of sort of abandonment of the humanities and more interest in STEM majors and whatnot. And we saw a mass exodus of college and university presidents. So a lot of them moving, you know, one president decided to go be the president of a museum, or they were jumping from one university to another, and there were a lot of scandals. And interestingly, every now and then we'd find out that somebody was involved in some sort of scandal, and maybe we might not want to quote them in the book anymore. Mm. And I would joke with my husband that it was almost impossible to remove a quote from the book because I had worked so hard on the transitions between the quotes. So if person A was talking about a particular topic, I had to figure out how to write the perfect transition to sort of build upon what they had said and then bridge to the next quote, that if I had to remove a quote, the entire chapter fell apart. And so I joked with my husband that it was sort of like in the old days when you had Christmas lights, where if one light bulb went out, they all went out.
Yeah, right.
And it was horrible because if I had to make any changes to the book, it felt like the entire chapter would sort of fall apart and then I'd have to sort of start all over again. The hardest part of this book, honestly, was making sure that we had all of the president's names, credentials, titles, and institutions accurate at the time of publishing, because it was changing literally up until the time of publishing.
Wow. Wow. So in some cases, you're quoting people who were college presidents at the time, and maybe by the time the book saw print, are former college
right,
presidents.
Many retired, many moved on to other things, many went to other institutions. And we tried really hard to actually tell you where they went, too.
Right.
So that was not an easy process, but we make sure very upfront in the book that we just say, like, any errors or omissions, if we got it wrong, please forgive us, but we tried really hard.
Well, speaking of not easy, something that we don't need to dwell on this too long, but I do think it's interesting and good for our listeners to know that, as if all of this wasn't challenging enough, you also faced a very, very serious health situation, which had to be an enormous complication in all of this. I want to just invite you to share whatever you feel comfortable sharing with our listeners about what you experienced, what you endured. And I guess I'm particularly interested in, the reason I'm asking is because I suspect that had a very direct impact on how this book took shape and the way in which you worked on this book.
Thank you. Yeah, I think, you know, it's always important, I think, for us to understand the humanity behind the work, because while I might have written a really important book here, you know, I'm just a human, and I had a really human experience while I was going through this. So I was born with a genetic condition called hypermobile Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, which is a connective tissue disorder. I have sort of mutated and disordered collagen throughout my body, which is a problem because collagen is sort of what builds pretty much everything. Tendons, ligaments, organs, the vascular system, the eyeballs, the muscles, the bones, right? So in addition to being just very, very bendy, so I should have been in like Cirque du Soleil, it's not good to have bendy tendons and ligaments, which means it doesn't hold your joints together, or to have very, very stretchy tissues in your vascular system, for example. And so I wasn't diagnosed until my mid-40s, which finally made my life make sense. And I had continued recently to develop. So the things a lot of people know about EDS is that we dislocate our joints when we move, right? So, you know, you take a step and your ankle comes out of the socket. And that's a daily thing, you know, 5, 6, 8, 10 dislocations a day.
Oh.
I was actually in a gigantic brace and using a walker 2 days ago, but walked in here into the studio on my own 2 feet today. But the biggest challenge that I've been having lately is related to my spine and my spinal cord. So in the midst of working on this project, I started discovering that I was having trouble walking, and I was walking on my toes, and I was tripping. I had what was called an ataxic gait, which sort of looks like you've had a stroke. And then I was having trouble swallowing, and I was having trouble breathing. And then I would sometimes lose the ability to speak for 20 minutes at a time. And I was getting confused. And ultimately what had happened is that there's a little tiny piece of tissue at the bottom of the spinal cord called the phylum. And in a healthy person, it's like a string, and it's long and stretchy. So when you bend, your spinal cord has sort of play. It has move. You know, you can kind of go everywhere. In people with my condition, that little piece of tissue happens to be very short, and it gets stiff, and it gets stiffer over time. It's actually the only thing that's not bendy in
a
person's body.
That sounds like the opposite of what you were describing.
It's absolutely the opposite, right? So we have these bendy bodies, but we have stiff phylums at the bottoms of our spinal cords. So what essentially happens is we get what's called a tethered spinal cord, which impacts everything. And in my case, I was so severely tethered that it was pulling my brainstem into my spinal column. And so if I twisted at the waist or I moved my head just wrong, my brain would just completely fade out. I was blocking off blood flow into my brain. I was getting very confused. I was very sick. I couldn't manage my body temperature. I was, you know, having strokes. I have a crooked smile as a result now. And it was very, very, very difficult experience. And I just, I explain it as when it would get really bad, I thought I was dying and I wish I would. And I was working on this book, and I was very sick. I ultimately had a risky surgery called tethered cord release at Frederick and the Medical College of Wisconsin in Milwaukee, where a very daring neurosurgeon drilled a hole in my sacrum and that sort of block of bone at the base of the spine and pulled my spinal cord inside of its dura out through a hole and opened up the dura and snipped the phylum off. He said that he knew I would feel better immediately because I was so tethered that my spinal cord literally retracted back into my body.
Wow.
So, yeah, I spent a couple days in the hospital and came home.
Actually, only two, believe it or not. Wow.
And then came home and learned how to walk again. And I'm still having trouble with a lot of things because I'm so stretchy and because I don't have normal tendons and ligaments, my entire spine now is very, very hypermobile. And so when I turn, I'm sort of pulling sort of vertebra sort of off the stack, sort of just think of like Jenga blocks getting popped out. And that's kind of how that works. So my neck is incredibly loose and we are working right now. I have a neck brace here with me in the studio and I'm actually really thrilled to be on radio and not television because without the ability to hold on to a table in front of me or to shift my position, I have a lot of trouble holding my head up. It's sort of akin to trying to hold a pumpkin on top of a toothpick. And so what we're going to do about my inability to hold up my head is sort of remains to be seen with lots of crazy things. But writing this book was really difficult because one of the most horrible things to do when you have a tethered cord or a loose cervical spine is to be leaning forward, sort of leaning towards a computer screen. And in my case, making millions of micro movements where I would be looking at a transcript on the screen, then tilting my head down so I could scribble something in a notebook or copying and pasting from document to document. And so I was moving my head up and down and back and forth millions of times over and over and over again.
Wow.
On a loose craniocervical joint. My head does not sit safely on top of my neck. And so I got very, very sick. I finished the book, believe it or not, late, but which is not surprising. But I finished it on a cruise ship on a vacation that should have happened after the book was done. And we couldn't figure out how to get my neck to a neutral position to be able to safely finish writing when I took like a laptop with me on the cruise. Mm. My husband, Robert Colbert, man, he should just be like, his name should be on the front of this book. So he's an IT professional. And I was getting very sick on the cruise ship. And I said, I can't look down at the laptop. What am I going to do? We're on deadline. And he figured out how to put a trash can on top of a desk, a little square trash can. And he had a full-size keyboard with him, and we adjusted the screen, and we put pillows under me and around me and held me up, and then I would wear a neck brace, and we have pictures of this. I wrote, this is a very long book, 156,000 words. I wrote the last 45,000 words all propped up with this like trash can computer setup in the stateroom of a cruise ship on our way along the Mexican Riviera. And it was physically an incredibly difficult experience, but knowing that this book was going to make a difference for millions of college students and thousands of people who work in and around higher education is what kept me going. There were many days where I thought, who would want to live like this? Who would want to have a body like this? Who would want to get up tomorrow? I would often get on airplanes and I would mutter out loud, please let this plane crash. Please let this plane crash. And I didn't want to let Joe and Elvin down. I wanted to finish this book. I wanted this book to make a difference in this world. And so in many ways, I stayed alive to finish this book. So thank you for asking. My health continues to be challenging, but the spinal cord is detethered, and that's one step in the right direction.
Wow. So glad to hear it, and I appreciate you sharing all of that. And it makes me appreciate the book and your efforts on it all the more, as I'm sure our listeners all agree. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Kate Colbert, who is one of the people responsible for a really amazing new book called Commencement, The Beginning of a New Era in Higher Education. This book gathers together primarily the observations of 125 college and university presidents across the country, reflecting on the dramatically changing state of higher education and the ways in which higher education is called upon to do new things in new ways, and what it is that the typical college student, if there's even such a thing, what they are looking for, what they need higher education to give them. And the book is quite comprehensive in its scope and really impressive. And actually, there's far more here than we can possibly touch on in the space of a single morning show. One of the things that I did want to be sure to touch on in some detail is the chapter about COVID. And
yeah.
You've already talked about the fact that the book took place to some extent during that time of COVID, and as did, of course, the whole podcast, the EdUp Experience, which was kind of the initial point of connection between
right.
all of these different college and university presidents and so on. One of the things that you talk about in this chapter called Pandemic as Panacea is that, among other things, the COVID pandemic taught essentially everybody in the world of higher education that dramatic change and rapid change was actually possible. I want to read just a really interesting passage, and I think these are your words. This is on page 242. The pandemic taught us that change is possible, that committees aren't entirely necessary, and that there are no legitimate reasons, and frankly never have been, why higher education can't make fast-paced decisions to immediately and positively benefit students, staff, and faculty. Literally overnight, the higher education industry became all the things we've always wanted to be: agile, collaborative, compassionate, vulnerable, nimble, and profoundly less bureaucratic. I mean, even as someone who lived through that, I mean, who was trying to do opera workshop and voice lessons
right,
and so on.
Right, via Zoom.
through the course of the pandemic. I'm not sure, even at the time, I fully appreciated all of the different ways in which what we all did in higher education had to change. I mean, it was obvious that a lot had changed, but I think you're talking even above and beyond what was immediately apparent to us, and speaking to more fundamental changes that we probably don't fully appreciate even now. And I think what you're saying is those are incredibly valuable lessons that higher education needs to learn better and sort of take to heart.
Yeah.
Tell us more about that really important observation.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you. And that's actually one of the many brilliant things I said in the book, right? Yeah, that actually was me. All the poll quotes are me. You're absolutely right. So everyone was in it. Faculty members were so busy trying to figure out how to serve their students. And one of the big, I think, challenges that you all as faculty faced was this: how do I help them achieve the objectives of this course, to develop the competencies and skills that they were intended to develop through this course, and do it from a distance, and do it when everyone's scared, and do it when maybe the student is also sharing a laptop with other family members who are mm-hmm. trying to study and work from home. And how do I do it in a way that does not have students at the end say, "I'm sorry, I paid for a private liberal arts college coming-of-age experience on campus with social clubs and friends and football games and whatnot, and I'm still paying that premium price for this Zoom experience," right? So the faculty really were the front line of figuring out how to keep students engaged, how to keep students enrolled. So there was a massive, in higher ed, we love to complain about enrollment. You know, how many students can we get for the fall term, right? It's always just for the fall term, which is silly. but But the real issue became, and has been for a long time, retention. How do we keep the students that we have recruited and get them all the way through to some sort of graduation or completion of a certificate or whatnot? And so the faculty were really on the front line of that. In fact, a lot of studies have shown that at many institutions, anywhere between 85 and 95% of the time that a student interacts with the college or university is with the faculty. Right? And so, but are the faculty being appropriately resourced? Are they being appropriately trained? Are they being appropriately supported? And so you all were at the very front of that, but you're absolutely right. The changes happened to the entire culture, to the entire system. College and university presidents and deans and chief academic officers were having to make big decisions. And they were having to make them without committees, without a board meeting, without, you know, things were happening overnight. And some of the presidents we interviewed for this book just said, listen, you know, we came right out and told our staff and faculty, you know, do whatever it takes in order to, you know, to make sure that you're doing the right things for the students and for each other. And looking back on that, we now, I think, colleges and universities belong to two camps. One is the camp of folks who realized, wait, we can be nimble. We can move quickly. We don't have to be stuck in these weird old traditions. And, you know, we can operate in the era in which we exist and not the era in which we were founded, which for many institutions is 150, 200 years ago. And then there's the other camp of folks who, as soon as their campuses reopened and things seemed to settle down and people stopped wearing masks or being tested for COVID so often, they went right back to these sort of old school ways of operation. And sadly, the institutions that have gone back, they do it at their peril because their students, their customers, have seen a different and better way. They have seen more compassion. They have seen what happens when they say, but my car broke down and a $400 repair on my car is enough to keep me from being able to come back to class and I'm going to have to drop out. And some institutions are saying, don't worry, we actually have, you know, we have grants, we have emergency grants, like we'll give you the $400, get back to class on Monday. And then there are institutions that aren't doing things like that and not meeting students where they are. And the institutions that learned a lot, that's why we call it pandemic as panacea. There were so many problems in higher ed, and the pandemic actually forced us to fix many of them. The institutions that have figured it out and realized, wait, this was an opportunity for us to evolve and grow and sort of kill some sacred cows and innovate in new ways, those are the ones that are doing well and that are growing. And the ones that went right back to the old way of doing things are the ones that are showing up in those lists of colleges that are being acquired or more likely closing. And we've seen a lot of colleges and university closures in the last, even just the last couple of months.
Right. It's an interesting world, and I think one of the intriguing things is a great line. I probably can't lay my hands on it, but at some point somebody says that, you know, one of the things you learn in higher education is that more than one thing can be true at the same time.
Yeah.
And so, you know, in a sense, When one talks about, for instance, completely innovating and kind of, of shucking away the old and so on, that in a sense, you know, that might be true, but that doesn't have to be the entire story. That there is a place for tradition, there is a place for, you know, there's a place for more things than one thing at a time. Or I guess that's one approach to this.
Yeah.
Which is a little less scary for maybe some of us who are maybe more rooted in tradition and are sort of terrified of the thought of all tradition being jettisoned. And of course, that isn't what this has to look like.
Not at all. And, you know, one of the things I talked about long before this book, when, you know, I would be advising colleges and universities that were 100 plus years old and were coming sort of to the market with different kinds of programs and different ways of, innovations like non-standard terms, all the schools that have gotten rid of the agrarian schedule and big semesters and have gone to sort of these non-standard terms, which you look at folks like Western Governors University, which is really innovated in this space and is growing leaps and bounds. I always tell people that it is both. It's not, oh no, things are changing, therefore the way it was when I was a college student is no longer being respected or well regarded. we are in a different time. It is possible for us to look at our storied past and be proud of where we've been and be proud and thankful to the leaders of those institutions who led us through certain eras, and yet to be able to say, upon that storied past, we're going to build a really bold new future. And perhaps that bold new future would not be possible had we not had these traditions, this story, and this history as an institution. So I think it's really important for colleges and universities to understand where they've been and their history. Actually, we did an interview with the president of Fresno State, and he talked a lot about it's important to understand how your institution was founded, for whom and why, because that can inform where you're headed, even if that has changed. And so, you know, he tells a really great story about how they're located where fruit farming. And so, like, what happened in their region when they figured out how to do sort of stone fruits, and what happened to the region, right? And do people who live near Fresno State, when they go to the grocery store, people who don't think of themselves as connected to colleges or universities at all, do they realize that the fruits and vegetables that are being sold in their grocery store are the results of agricultural innovations that are taught at Fresno State, right? And so it's really important, I think, for us to understand that by moving forward and evolving and innovating in higher education is not us sort of thumbing our nose at the past. You know, higher education and the pursuit of it is a time-honored tradition, but traditions change.
Right. They really do. And they need to.
Yeah.
By the way, I found the line, and this is your writing again. You wrote, and this is when you were talking about this need for us to think about more than just that pretty paper. That cannot be the end game, and that we need to really be thinking about the benefits of a higher education in objective, measurable ways. You do go on to say, but if our conversations with the brightest and most influential minds in higher education have taught us anything, it's that many things are simultaneously true in modern post-secondary education. And a few pages later, in that same chapter called Not Just a Pretty Piece of Paper, somebody named Lee Lambert from Pima Community College.
Yeah, he's great.
He says, we have to think about our degree programs and the context of skills. I'm not saying abandon degrees. It's not either or. This is an era of and not or. Conjunctive versus disjunctive thinking.
Yeah.
And I think that's really interesting. I mean, I'm sure it doesn't make sense for a given college to try to do absolutely everything.
Correct.
But on the other hand, it does not have to be completely an either or scenario, and probably should not be. I mean, that would not be of benefit to a given institution.
Yeah, I mean, Lambert really, so, you know, President Lambert really sort of nailed it. In fact, we actually opened the book. My opening line for the book is, higher education is no longer about or, it's about and.
Mm.
And so, you know, and so that's absolutely true. And you know, and I talk a little bit in the book about, you know, that today, to develop strategies and execute on them in a world of higher education requires fresh mindsets and a willingness to build upon or even abandon the activities and offerings that were once central to our identities. And that's really scary for people. But for folks who are not particularly risk averse and who are truly innovative, they can take us in interesting places. When we did our research, we actually asked people, how sort of risk tolerant do you think you are? And our leaders thought that they really are, but I'm not sure if we asked all of their colleagues, they would agree to that. And but you know, one of the key, we asked about what is it going to take to lead higher education, and we looked at sort of what we call a new sort of leadership skill set of the future, and a comfort with new operating models and new business and sort of innovative approach to sort of managing change was way up there as one of the most important things we need in leaders in higher ed. That is not what we were talking about 10 years ago. 10 years ago, we wanted a college president to have come up through the ranks as a faculty member and then maybe a department chair and then maybe a provost and then eventually a VP and eventually president. And we want them to have been in a classroom. And we didn't care if they had any business experience. We didn't care if they had any leadership experience. And we wanted them to basically sort of toe the line and continue the status quo from a fancier office. And today we're saying the status quo in higher education just doesn't work.
The book goes on to explore really important principles like that of diversity and inclusiveness and affordability, and about this whole notion of what does this lead to? What ultimate tangible benefit is this degree, and what is it that students want, and of course the rapidly shifting desires of students, all explored. I want to circle back, and I'm afraid we just have a couple of minutes left, but you know, one of the themes of your book is thinking in more practical, tangible terms about what this leads to. On the other hand, your own personal story is in some respects a little at odds with that,
sure,
in that you received a certain education, and look at what you have done with that education that, you know, that you yourself said, in a sense, in a tangible way, did not prepare you for all you've gone on to accomplish. So what do we do with that? Is it that the world itself is different now, and that the environment is different, and that your story would not play out that way now? Or is it that that is a very exceptional story, and that we need to think about a broader swath of students being able to access similar opportunities?
Yeah, you know, listen, there are always going to be students and families for whom sending an 18-year-old off for a coming-of-age experience, living on a campus, having no idea what they want to be when they grow up, spending $20,000, $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 a year on tuition, room, and board is something that they want to do and that they can do. But if we're going to talk about access in higher education, we have to acknowledge that that description, that quote-unquote traditional student that I just described, which, by the way, about 73% of college students today do not fit that description.
Mm.
So the non-traditional is actually traditional.
Right.
You know, but we have to acknowledge that that set of students, by and large, carries a lot of privilege. You know, they're typically white. They're typically upper middle class or wealthy. And they have a lot of flexibility in their lives to be able to go do this. That's not the story for most college students today. The United States currently has 39 million individuals who have some college and no degree. They've earned some credit somewhere and didn't finish a degree. We need to be serving them. And there are unbelievable institutions who are serving them well. But yes, if I were to go back to college today, I would not major in English, and I'm not afraid to admit that. I had a great experience in college, but I went all the way through my associate's, my bachelor's, and my first master's degree, not really knowing what in the world I was going to do when I got out into the quote-unquote real world. And we talk about that in the book, that the real world and higher education have to be paired. You have to be able to have had an internship, some practical skills, come out of college with an employment offer. Most of us don't have the luxury of quote-unquote sort of figuring it out once you graduate.
Right.
And so, you know, what are you going to do when you graduate? So absolutely, you're right. I went through that sort of old school traditional model. I happen to think that it's a model that is dying, and the data shows that it is. And I'm really, really proud of institutions like Carthage College that rooted in the liberal arts, but that said several years ago, what does it look like if critical thinking can meet critical need? When Carthage College, for example, decided to open a nursing program, which was not all that well understood by their stakeholders at first, and now it's their biggest program, and they're really serving the community and the economy and society in brilliant ways. So we have to take a look at how do we evolve the institutions that currently exist to be more, to be better, to be different, and to your point, not to be all things for all people, but to figure out where do you want to make a difference and what students do you want to serve and how are you going to get busy doing it. But there are fewer and fewer 18-year-olds right now because of a demographic shift, because of a birth rate decline about 18 years ago. And
right.
So enrollment at community colleges is down 10%, and we're looking at enrollment being down up to 15% across the board in the United States by 2025. So we wrote this book in this time frame for a reason, so that colleges and universities could have some proof of what's happening at other institutions. And I would recommend people take a look at the insights from places like Foundry College is a really great opportunity to take a look at what does it look like to go to school for 6 months or so and to have a higher education credential and an industry credential, and to be able to step out with a job with a family supporting wage.
A lot of intriguing and incredible ideas shared in this really amazing book, again titled Commencement, The Beginning of a New Era in Higher Education, and one of its authors, Kate Colbert. Kate Colbert, Thank you so much, first of all, for all that you did to make this book possible and for joining me today on The Morning Show to talk about it. I think you've given all of us hearing this conversation a lot to think about, which is so important in and of itself. So thank you so much and very, very best wishes to you.
Thank you.
It is 8:59. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. NPR News and classical music on your gateway to public radio. Coming up at 9:01, we'll join Wisconsin Public Radio and National Public Radio for the news. And then throughout the morning, we'll have Wisconsin Public Radio's classical music programming. But between now and then, let's update the weather forecast details for you from the National Weather Service. Today, a sunny and cold one, a high reaching only 39. Some perspective on that number. Normal high this time of year would be 44. The record high, look at this, we hit 78 degrees March 14th, 2012. Tonight then, sunset 6:57. Very cold overnight, a low of 17. Looking ahead now, Wednesday, partly sunny and 50.